Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, joined by Michael Steele, the former chairman of the Republican National Committee. Boy, that is a strange thing, isn't it, given where you are now?
Yeah, I mean, no.
Hey, good morning, first of all.
Good morning to you, Charlie. It's always good to be with you, brother.
So I actually decided to prep for this by, and this was probably a mistake, going back and looking at the video of your discussion with Matt Schlapp. About the RNC. Now, for people who had forgotten this, you had somebody up at somebody up at CPAC that basically said you got the job because you were the black guy or something,
right?
And then Matt Schlapp, and I want to talk about him as sort of an example of what's happened. He sort of apologized, non-apologized, and you just weren't having it.
Yeah, it was a very disturbing moment. And I think in many respects, Charlie, it showed just how fractured the party had become. This event blew up out of nowhere. It was during the CPAC meeting here at National Harbor in Washington, D.C., in Prince George's County area last year. And the communications director, a person of color, stands up at their big dinner on Friday evening and says, you know, that we have to be, you know, these conservatives and this certain kind of conservatives. And, you know, let's just be honest. The party elected Michael Steele because he was a black man. And the room was like, what? And of course, I was across the hall because we were covering CPAC, and I was across the hall wrapping up my radio show at the time, and people come running in. Did you hear what just happened? So I, got the lowdown, called Matt Schlapp that evening and said, look, Matt, this is unacceptable. Seriously, you guys are going after me for this way. You're going to play the race card? Really? So he said, well, let's talk about it. So he came was on the radio show, Charlie, and proceeds to double down on it. That was the part that was so stunning to me. Was it wasn't an apology. It was like, you know, it was sort of this, you know, if I offended anybody kind of deal, you know,
yeah,
I'm sitting
right
here. You offended me. I'm sitting right here, you know. But it said to me a lot about how far the Trump effect had corroded some core ideas and principles of this party and gave license and comfort to this sort of attitude that we can now speak freely about what we really think, about what we really feel about the party, about people inside the party, et cetera. And it was a real eye-opening moment for me. And you see it, and I've watched you deal with this on air and in conversations, this sort of mindset that says, oh, you know, this is the new party. And we're like, no, this is not the new party. Sorry.
Yeah. What makes this so interesting is, you know, looking at the rundown of CPAC, and you and I are both old enough to remember when CPAC was pretty, you know, I mean, it was the, you know, Star Wars bar scene of the conservative movement, but it was part of the conservative movement. And you had prominent conservatives. And now watching what's happened in the era of Trump and what, you know, Matt Schlapp, who runs CPAC, you know, watching his transformation, because, you know, I was actually there at CPAC the year, the day, the moment when Donald Trump refused to come. He decided, and Schlapp was then like a reasonable guy, or at least I was under the impression he was a reasonable guy, and he wasn't going to give in. And lo and behold, you've seen the transformation of CPAC into, you know, basically Trump, you know, Trump PAC.
You're right.
To basically almost a cartoon version of what it used to be.
No, it is absolutely a cartoon version. It's actually not a very good cartoon version of itself, because what you have is a group of people who will go on that stage when CPAC occurs this month. And not they will give lip service to the values of, you know, the folks that you and I remember who come before CPAC, you know, a Ronald Reagan, a William F. Buckley, and guys like that. They'll give lip service to it, but they don't know what those words mean. They don't know how those words fit into not just the history of the Republican Party, but how they're important and relevant for the future of the Republican Party. And instead, they will spew more Trumpism. It will be invective that will identify opponents. It will be hot rhetoric to sort of stir illogical passions. And it will not advance the cause of conservatism, which particularly among young libertarian oriented conservatives, CPAC was there, you know, was that sort of forming ground for people to sort of come in and find a gateway into the party. So I think in that sense, it has become a very bad caricature of itself. And I can't tell you the number of people who I just don't go anymore. I stopped going, you know, people cut back their support financially. And it's because of those very things that we're talking about that have turned people away from going and participating.
So I don't want to make this too personal about Matt Schlapp.
Sure.
That was totally insincere, by the way, because I do. I love talking about Matt because I can use words like oleaginous. It's so perfect. Give me some sense of the psychology, though. I mean, I understand the attraction of power and celebrity and the whole grift. But, you know, what does motivate people?
Well, it starts I think it starts with the fact that his wife works in the White House.
Yeah, but he was pretty oleaginous before she even made it to the White House.
I mean, he's
part
started.
Of it. He oiled her way in before she.
I think it's recognizing the shortest, quickest route to the very things that you're talking about, you know, the sense of power, money. I mean, this all boils down. I mean, the party is becoming, I saw this firsthand inside the Republican Party as chairman. They're the sort of the consultant class, the money class inside the party that doesn't give a rat's patootie about values and principles and ideas. It's about, okay, how do you triangulate this into cash? How do you get cash out of it? How do you build brand around it? And you know, we'll use those values, those ideas, those wonderful words of Reagan as props to invoke those passions so people write those checks. So that you have all these interests and influences that sort of come into this space in a way, and he was a part of that, and still is in many respects. And I think it was recognizing that Donald Trump could serve a number of masters within the party. The problem is they didn't realize just how badly it would turn out for the party in the main. So once you're in, Charlie, you're in.
Yeah, you're totally in.
You're totally in.
So, you know, it's worth stepping back and realizing how remarkable it is that you are the former chairman of the Republican National Committee. You are the top Republican.
Yeah.
Where are you now?
Oh, I'm still a Republican. I'll give you an analogy that I think that it helps put it in the context of why I stay and why I fight. This fight is worth it to me. So if I come to your home and, you know, either I'm invited or I come as a guest of someone else and I'm there and we're having a nice dinner and all of a sudden I take my plate and I throw it on the floor and then I knock your fine china over. I take my penknife and start cutting, you know, holes in your curtain. And I go into your kitchen and start ripping up your floorboards. Do you leave your house or do you kick me out?
Good analogy. But the problem is those folks now, you know, claim to own the house. They're starting to redecorate the house.
Well, they're
moving in.
That's true.
Using the bathroom. They're going through your stuff.
That's true. But, you know, I'm kind of an old frontiersman in the sense this is my home. You know, it's worth the fight for me. So, I'm not going to leave my house. I mean, I've been in this party since 1976, and I'll be damned if I'm going to let, you know, some vagabond, someone who's not even a Republican, someone who's not even a conservative, come into my home and remake it. Yeah, I've got some idiots inside my house who are kind of buying what he's selling, and I'll slap them around too if I have to sort of get them to wake up like that, you know. That great moment with Cher slapping the crap in Moonstruck, you know, I was like, snap out of it. Yeah. But the fight for me, Charlie, is worth it because Trump is transitory. And that's what people don't seem to get. So if this is the new Republican Party when he's gone, okay, to your point, they have now sufficiently moved in enough and redecorated enough that, okay, there's no chair for me to sit down on. I got that. And I'm willing to deal with that at that point. But until that point, it matters to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because what drew me into the party is what I still believe is worth fighting for. So
let's talk about what the RNC is all about. Now, have you talked with Reince Priebus at all in the last couple of years? Who is your successor?
No, not really.
You guys are not tight, anyway. We had a long going sort of disagreement during the rise of Trump, and I perhaps was naive, and I wanted to bounce this off of you.
Mm-hmm.
That the Republican Party was separate. There was a Republican Party that was not Donald Trump, and as he was using his position as RNC chair to advance Trump and Trumpism. You know, I kind of pushed back and said, look, I mean, isn't there? But the Republican Party is a big thing, and there's 50 states, and there's lots of people. You know, does the RNC have to be a complete and total creature of Donald Trump? And he basically was arguing, this is my job, I have to do this. And under McDaniel, it basically is an extension of the Trump White House and the Trump campaign. So is it naive for me to think that the RNC could have kept any distance at all from Trump? Or is this just the nature of our politics and the nature of that beast, which you used to run?
Your instincts and inclination on this is absolutely correct. Reince was full of crap. Reince chose the path he took because it was a personal benefit to him. I asked the question. I mean, when he filled out his financial statement, I'm trying to figure out how a lawyer from Wisconsin is worth $8 million. All right.
Okay.
So I go back to the point I made about the finances, the financial interests here, play a big part. The personal gain and influence play a big part. The manipulation of the system. I remember during the setup for the debate, I made the case directly to Reince. Don't do it this way because you're shortchanging the wrong people.
Mm-hmm.
You're creating this sort of kiddie table where, you know, guys like John Kasich and others are not being considered. And again, why is Trump center stage in every debate? People forget Donald Trump started off at 2%. And yeah, you know, people talk about, well, you know, when the Access Hollywood tape came out, Reince went to him and you know, tried to get him out of the race.
Right.
At that point, it's too late. That was a self-preservation move more than anything else. But even then, what happened? The wheels of the organization were turned loose on behalf of Donald Trump.
Right.
For his own survival. So yes, all of this could have been avoided if done differently, if proper emphasis were placed on the values of the party. Let me give you a good example. How do you allow the Russians to come in and to write planks into your national platform?
Yeah, that seems like a legitimate question.
How does that happen? I mean, how do you allow all these people who have all these ties? So look, I went to I kid you not, Charlie, I went to an inaugural event. And I talked to more Russians that one evening than I had in my entire life at an inaugural event. So this idea is part and parcel of the support that Trump had counted on. You know, there was something in it for Reince. He became chief of staff.
Yeah.
And I think we all know the stories about how that came about. So the fact of the matter
And how it ended. How that worked out for him.
So a lot of this was putting the party's interests, in my view, secondary. And while people came after me because they didn't like who I spent money on and the campaigns that I supported, that's fine. We can have that debate. But at every point, you cannot look back and go, oh, gee, Michael was self-interested. You know, Michael was making the sacrifices that any chairman would make and all of my predecessors had made for the greater good of the party's opportunity to win.
So So let's look ahead, and because you're trying to get your house back again, and the question is the Republican Party salvageable? So look ahead to the next couple. Well, let's look ahead to the next couple of years, but let's look short term. So the president declares a national emergency, the exact thing that every Republican denounced when Barack Obama did it. Could I just emphasize that? It was exactly. Remember all the hair on fire and the heads exploding over that. There are Republicans who do recognize two things. Number one, the potential danger and damage to constitutional checks and balances. That's on principle. More prudentially recognizing the terrible precedent it will set going forward for a Democratic president. So, there are Republicans that are willing to speak out. How optimistic are you that Republicans will recognize this as a red line, will do something that they haven't done so far, which is to stand up to the president?
Oh, I think we have more bottom to hit there, Charlie. I think the reckoning comes, and you're already beginning to see the reality of that reckoning hit Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell going into 2021 will not be the majority leader of the Senate.
Really?
I think the Senate is, we've got 24 seats up in blue states. Hello. And right now, the polling in six of those states have the Republican senators in trouble. So the question becomes, at what point does this become every senator for himself? And they decide that they can no longer afford what Donald Trump costs them. And if they want to be a United States senator when the gavel is thrown down in 2021, then they have to course correct. I think for some it'll be too late. I think for others it may be salvageable, but that will be a reckoning for the party. Especially should Donald Trump win re-election, to look across and see Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi standing there with the majority, and a second term that will basically be undone. And the question for those senators is whether or not, and for the party as a whole, is do you learn from this and then regroup? If Trump loses next year, you've got a Democrat, you're still probably looking at and certainly in that case, you're absolutely probably looking at a Senate Democratic majority with a Democratic president. It becomes a very different landscape. And here's the rub. All the stuff that we did to excuse, ignore Trump's behavior and his decisions, especially the more recent ones, will come back to bite when that Democratic president declares a national emergency on climate. Or a national emergency after another gun shooting on guns, and then what do you do? That's the reckoning to come.
And it's so predictable when you think about it. It is completely. It does not require a great deal of imagination.
No, it doesn't. It's not rocket science.
So here's something that I've done with other Trump skeptical Republicans, and it goes back to, and I always try to give Jonah Goldberg credit for coming up with this, that the last 2 years has been a little bit like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, watching one person after another go, oh my God, they got you. It's like so. What is there any person that surprised you the most? I mean, I'm in the back of my mind, I'm thinking of at the moment, Lindsey Graham. If somebody would have predicted Lindsey Graham would become the lick spittle of the United States Senate for Donald Trump, I wouldn't have called that. There are a lot of surprising ones. From Lindsey Graham's up there. Anybody else that really surprises you?
Well, Lindsey's at the top of my list. Yeah. I was just talking about him earlier this morning, as a matter of fact. I think probably Paul Ryan, the way he was so beaten down by Trump, which was to me just stunning. And it kind of affirmed for me that the man shouldn't have had the job in the first place. I mean, not that he wasn't capable or competent to do it. That has nothing to do. I just don't think his heart was really ever in it. I mean, when you go through the kind of machinations he went through to get the job, where he was basically saying, I don't want it, but okay.
Yeah.
It's not going to inspire the kind of confidence in the rank and file when you really have to go up against some difficult moments. So, guys like him, are really disappointing. You know, I look at some others in media who, you know, just kind of carry that water. Sometimes they, you know, the bucket's half empty. Sometimes the bucket's half full for Trump. And, you know, I that's kind of laughing at Ann Coulter and her sort of flip. her flipping out on Trump. And I was like, okay, wait a minute. So
in Trump, we trust.
In Trump, we trust. Right. So, yeah, I think there are any number of people who kind of.
Ann Coulter actually does believe something. I'm not trying to praise her. I mean, she's a flat out racist, but at least she, as opposed to the match slaps and others who will just go along with anything. I mean, it's totally transactional. She actually had something that she thought she was going to get for it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I can't begrudge her that part, but I also, you know, go back and remember her tweets and her points in supporting Trump as well. And so what strikes me in all of this, and this is my bottom line when it comes to this whole Trump effect, I don't know how you can stand in the shadow of Reagan and embrace Trump. I don't understand that. That to me, and you use the word I think that defines the moment, transactional. That again, the Republican Party and a lot of its cohorts have become transactional in their relationship.
I understand that.
Rick Wilson, I think, put it best on the heels of Trump's decision this past week to declare a national emergency. And he said that what this shows is that Republicans that their values have become disposable, or they've just completely gone off the rails, and there is no coming back from that. So it's a no-win situation when you sort of, again, if you've carried the luggage of Ronald Reagan for the past 30 plus years, and those things still mean something, and you still value that, I don't know how you then, like a Lindsey Graham and others, sort of turn that corner and go, okay, I can just leave these bags here and move on with this.
Well, you know, let me ask you this, because you've been around a long time. I don't remember this pressure to conform under President Bush one, under Bush two. You could go out and criticize George W. and you didn't have the flying monkeys and the trolls descend upon you. You weren't labeled a cuck or a rhino. There was actually room for conservatives to debate one another. There was a, you know, vigorous conservative pushback against Richard Nixon. Why is this so different? Why is there so much pressure to be part of the tribe, of the cult? Or maybe using the word cult answers the question.
Well, it does the word feel cult. Like that. Yeah. Well, it does. And I think one of the elements of it, as I went back and I looked at this election, what Donald Trump did was something that really no politician had done before. And he had a particular advantage in doing so. He managed to make his viewers turn his viewers into his voters.
Yeah.
You're talking about a group of voters who hadn't voted in the process probably since 1996 was the last time a significant number of them really participated. Sort of the old Reagan Democrats who got turned off, went back to Clinton in 92, and by 96 had had enough. And so from 96 to 2016, those folks largely stayed out of the political process. So, yeah, you didn't have the kind of vitriol that you saw that you see now with a George Bush, for example. And to the extent that you began to get a sense that something different was forming, I saw it firsthand, as we all did, with the Tea Party emergence in 2009. But even that has started back in 2004, 2006 cycle, where a lot of those voters really began to express openly their frustration with the process. So it's been a gradual decline, I think, in many respects. But what Trump did was able to come in and re-galvanize that particular electorate. They'd gotten to know him. They saw him as a fighter. They thought he was a tough guy. They loved that sort of, you know, showmanship and all of those elements. And his promise to them, which is why he's so stuck on this wall thing, they took to heart. because they felt this was the first guy who would actually act on his promises. And so, yeah, it's a different space for a lot of the politicians now who feel pressure from those voters, because that's the difference. It's not it's not pressure from your fellow politicians.
Right, right. They're afraid
of
them.
People, yeah. It's the people that's standing behind them that they're afraid of.
So let's talk about 2020. Any thoughts about a primary challenge to Donald Trump? Former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld gets in. I'm not sure that that's the person everybody's been waiting for. But at least he might play a useful role of being a placeholder in New Hampshire, where he's somewhat well known. But do you think that there will be, should there be, a primary challenge, and what do you think the prospects are?
I think there should be. I think there will be, in addition to Weld. And I think the prospects, speak for themselves. It's going to be difficult. It's not something that's only really occurred once in our history, where a president, challenged that way, to some degree of success. We've seen the collapse when Teddy Kennedy and Carter and, Perot and, Bush. And so you do have, it does not help the incumbent, for sure. Makes it more difficult for him to go into a general after a primary, which is why the Republican Party is now a wholly owned subsidiary of the Trump campaign. The RNC is, and they want to cut off any ability or access that a candidate would have. Here's the problem.
Yeah, not a sign of confidence, by the way.
Right, exactly. If I'm a candidate, if I'm Bill Weld, and I go to the RNC for data and resources and information as any candidate for office can do, and you don't give it to me, guess where you're going to find yourself?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to find yourself in court, not just in the court of public opinion, but in a legal court, explaining why I'm not entitled to this. And that's why members were during their last meeting were trying to get resolutions passed that declared Donald Trump the de facto nominee of the party and just forego the primary altogether, because they know it's coming. They know it's coming.
Well, what about your fellow Marylander? Is that how you pronounce it? Marylander?
Marylander, yes.
Marylander, yeah. Larry Hogan, who is clearly testing the water.
Yeah. Well, I was just with the governor last night, and we were mm-hmm. laughing about that. And, I think he's, obviously flattered and sees encouragement in that. I'm still not convinced it's something that he does, for a variety of reasons, that are personal to him. But, I think that, right now he has an opportunity to at least, along with Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, and other like-minded Republican governors, of which there are some who maybe not as vocal as those two gentlemen are, but they can create a space, Charlie, for voices like ours to find a place to settle and resonance, because they've got good governance to show for it. They can show how their center-right policies and efforts in very difficult states, blue states like Maryland and Massachusetts, have been met with a great deal of success by the voters, and to the point where they're the two most popular governors in the country, Democrat or Republican.
In intensely Democratic states.
In intensely Democratic states. And it tells you a lot that at the core, where voters are, they're looking for stable leadership. They're looking for quality leadership. They're looking for men and women who know how to sort of edge around those sharp, thorny, partisan things that stick out and make it more difficult to get things done. They know how to smooth those edges in a way that creates success for their states. And so I think you're going to see the governor talk a lot more about that. He becomes, I believe, head of the RGA, the Republican Governors Association, this year. He's the next to ascend to that position. So it'll be interesting to see how he uses that platform to engage a national conversation about good governance, good Republican governance.
And you think about what the Republican Party will be like post-Trump. Governors like that will play a significant
role.
You know, I wish we had more time, because I really want to get into what's going on in 2020 and what the Democrats are doing. So can we have you back, Michael?
Oh, absolutely.
Because we have a lot to talk about.
We do.
Michael,
and I'd like to return the favor. Have you come over to the Michael Steele podcast and share some thoughts as well.
Absolutely. Anytime you want. Hey, thanks for joining me. Thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.